Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
We decided to do this in-house, but we had a lot of people wanting to come, so you thought that'd be nice and friendly, or at least pretend you're nice and friendly, or at least pretend you're friendly, or whatever. So Lisa Pryor's here, and I'll introduce her very briefly. She graduated in law at the University of Sydney. She headed off to the Sydney Morning Herald to be a journalist, or she said she escaped her career in law. She was, until very recently, opinion page editor on the Sydney Morning Herald. In that situation, I was very respectful. And now she's a Saturday columnist, or continues as a Saturday columnist for the Sydney Morning Herald. But because she's now an author, we don't have to be that respectful anymore. So it's good to have Lisa along tonight. The occasion of the publication of her first book, The Pinstripe Prison, and Janet Grundy from Books & Tech has got some copies out there. And tonight the topic is overachieving and self-loathing in contemporary Australia. Lisa, you're most welcome.
Thanks very much, Jared, and for having me tonight. I'm actually really glad that this event tonight is being held at the Sydney Institute and not one of the other venues where Sydney Institute events often happen, which is the conference rooms of law firms, because it could have got quite ugly. So I think probably the Sydney Institute is about the only venue in the whole of the Sydney CBD that I haven't terribly defamed in my book. But I do feel that I can speak freely tonight. It's only 6 o'clock, so anyone who might be upset by what I have to say is probably still at work. In the buildings all around us, from Mallesons to Clayton Utes, from Goldman Sachs to Macquarie Bank, from McKinsey to Bain, the latest crop of analysts, consultants and solicitors are discovering what those a few years older already know. The corporate life is not all that's promised by the glossy recruitment brochures and the twilight cocktail parties. In the back rooms of the big firms, recruits are learning the work life is something like war. Long stretches of boredom, punctuated by fear and excitement when a deal closes or a case goes to court. The disillusionment that these recruits feel is particularly hard to bear when they think about how long and how hard they've been striving to be accepted and to get one of those jobs in a big firm. As I realised when researching the Pinstripe Prison, this striving starts long before graduates apply for their first job. It begins in high school, which is where achievaholic nerds are primed to become workaholic professionals. Through high schools, smart kids are taught to take pleasure in collecting accolades, whether it's winning academic prizes, captaining sporting teams, or excelling in music and drama. And through this, they learn the lesson that it's totally normal to start your work day at 6 a.m. with swimming squad and continue all the way through until you finish that last bit of your ancient history assignment at 11 p.m. They're perfectly primed for a workaholic life. And then when they finish school, they're told, like so many of us were, including myself and a few people I can see in this audience, that they shouldn't waste their marks by doing something they really enjoy. They should make the most of their marks by studying law, normally at Sydney Uni or New South. It's a very common pattern. So it's also really easy for kids who have learned to judge themselves by the marks they get to then take the small step of judging themselves by the salaries they earn. It's a bit of a conveyor belt. But then you have to wonder, how could these people, if they are the smartest and the best and the brightest, how can they be so easily tricked? Surely they can see through the spin from the big firms. And I would say that is a fair point, but I think you also have to consider how sophisticated some of the propaganda is in the recruitment process from big law firms, big consulting firms, and big banks. And one of my favourite areas of this propaganda is the recruitment brochure. It's a genre that's as manipulative as military recruitment material, only with a whole lot more stock photos of skyscrapers. In these recruitment brochures, these glossy brochures, firms have to tailor a message which makes office jobs sound exciting to kids in their 20s. Under no circumstances can a recruitment brochure give the impression that the jobs on offer are bland, repetitive, desk-bound, or identical to the jobs offered by their rivals. The trouble, of course, is that all the firms try to look unique in exactly the same way, using exactly the same language. Every firm is unique, dynamic, and diverse. These words come up again and again, along with others such as solution, team, environment, fast pace, culture, excellence. So you're almost like you can play a game of bingo by taking one of these brochures and just ticking off those words as they occur. In the hope that you might be able to help someone you know, someone close to you, avoid falling for the tricks of these recruitment brochures, I thought I'd just quickly run you through the four tricks that they use, the four rules of recruitment brochure literature, so you don't end up being caught out by them. Okay, rule number one, you have to appropriate the language of self-help and adventure tourism. So these brochures firms love saying in their brochures that their recruits challenge themselves every day. They climb amazing peaks as if they're mountaineers. An example of this is my favourite example of this is the following passage, which was in a particular brochure, and it says, this is what it says. It says, "When I walk around the different floors, there's a vibrancy about the place. Everyone is busy with interesting things they're enthusiastic about. People aren't running around constantly worried about what they have to do. You know, people are really busy, but they're still remaining calm. It's a hospitable place. You feel comfortable. It's pretty easy to fit in, regardless of where you come from or what you like." Now, to me, that sounds like someone with a name like Leaf describing a commune somewhere near Nimbin, but it isn't. It's a solicitor called Paul describing free hills. The second rule that you have to look out for, the second trick you need to look out for in recruitment brochures, is that they promise more diversity than a United Nations convention. If you believe what you read, the big firms of today are peopled by a rainbow coalition of different races, expertises, sexual orientations, religious persuasions, performing an endless variety of engaging tasks. Investment bank UBS says it reaches out to people from all social and educational backgrounds. Clayton Youth says it employs a diverse selection of people. And Cause 2 hires the very best lawyers from a diverse range of backgrounds. But again, the winner in this category of really pushing this rule to an extreme is Freehills, which claims that it is actually the only place that deserves the mantle of being diverse. It says, "The diversity among staff is also a unique feature of Freehills. Our partners are a mix of men and women, young and senior partners. Many are also achievers outside work, Olympic athletes, wine growers, university lecturers, and even members of successful rock bands. Our partners are not only mentors at work, but also mentors in life." So that's right, Freehills is diverse in the sense that it has people that are old and young, male and female. Some of them have colourful hobbies. The third rule of recruitment brochures is that you have to insist your greatest asset is your people. And in a way, this is kind of obvious, because any business, whatever it is, if it involves services rather than goods, its greatest asset is its people. It's all about people. But firms, again, have to hint that this somehow makes them unique among their peers. And when firms talk about the value of their people, one thing that's often drawn upon is this idea of work-life balance and making things easy for people with families. And Mallison's has a fantastic example of this in their brochure. because Mallison's is working to make work more human and therefore presumably less humanoid, robotic or animalistic. And a quote from their brochure is, like all major organisations, Mallison's is constantly looking for ways to make work more enjoyable, more fulfilling, more human. That's why we've implemented a major cultural change program called Making Work Work Together. Don't laugh though. As Mallison says, this is not a glib name for a policy that exists only on paper but is not properly practiced. Making Work Work Together is working right now in our firm. The final rule that I wanted to mention tonight of recruitment brochures is that they have to profess a culture as unique and intriguing as Easter Island. Every firm has a culture as unique as a snowflake, if you believe the hype, worthy of study by anthropologists for generations to come. Some firms have a culture which is unique because it's professional yet relaxed. Another might be unique because it's innovative and business-focused, or team-oriented yet valuing the individual. The Australian law firm Henry Davis York promises a highly professional service that is refreshingly down-to-earth, for example. And the quote is, that's very much our style. Professional, friendly, cohesive, progressive, caring, committed. In fact, their Sydney office is so buzzy that their energy is palpable. And this isn't just talk either. It's hard to put into words, they say. It's how you feel when you walk into HDY and deal with our people. That's not just rhetoric, it's reality. Of course, the overall message from these recruitment brochures is that every firm is unique. And of course, this causes terrible problems for students, when they're being interviewed for jobs, because you always get asked that inevitable question, why our firm? Why do you want our firm and not another one? And there is no answer. They all do the same thing. But I wanted to move on and consider a question that I keep getting asked since this book came out. Again and again, people have asked me, when I recount the sob story of these poor overachievers who are ending up in jobs, trapped in corporate jobs they hate, I get asked, why on earth should anyone have sympathy for the people that I'm writing about? Who cares if young people who are so privileged that they can... Who cares about young people who are so privileged they can manage to feel unhappy even when they're earning six-figure salaries? Why shouldn't we save our sympathy for people with real problems like homeless amputees or burgled pensioners or injured puppies? And it is a fair question. The trite answer I give is, who said anything about sympathy? It's funny. I think there's a wonderful irony in seeing our supposedly best and brightest being lured by shiny, bright things, like their babies being lured by a rattle, except it's not a rattle, it's a drawn to Switzerland for training, like Dom Knight in the back over there experience. Or the promise of a gourmet meal if you stay back and work past 8 p.m. in the office, or a big fat bonus. It is pretty funny. But my more serious answer, and this is where my speech starts to take the form of a 21st speech where you go, but really, and then get all serious. My serious answer, though, the question of sympathy, is that we should all care about these disillusioned corporate recruits. For a start, they're not simply shallow and money hungry. If they were, they wouldn't end up disillusioned by corporate life. They'd be quite satisfied by it. But more importantly, there is much more at stake here than the mild tragedy of talented individuals leading lives duller than they hoped for. What we're witnessing is a kind of brain drain. Regardless of whether or not corporate recruits enjoy their jobs, it affects the nation's economy, its culture and its future when some of the best minds of this generation are providing professional services to business rather than leading public policy development, making scientific breakthroughs or teaching the next generation. To illustrate this brain drain, I'd like to consider the career paths of Rhodes Scholars. Rhodes Scholars are supposedly the ultimate in well-rounded achievement. As the Rhodes Trust explains, Cecil Rhodes designed his trust for the purpose of educating future leaders of the world. He'd studied at Oxford and felt that its organisation especially fostered broad views and personal development. it takes a lot more than brains to be worthy of a Rhodes Scholarship. Rhodes desired scholars who were fond of sport and successful at it. They were also supposed to demonstrate qualities of truth, courage, devotion to duty, sympathy for and protection of the weak, kindliness, unselfishness and fellowship. As I researched my book, I thought if anyone could resist the siren song of the corporate tract, it should be Rhodes Scholars. But I was wrong. Very, very wrong. Now, of course, I feel a little bit evil being mean to Rhodes Scholars. It feels like pulling the wings off butterflies. Here I am, a muckraking journalist, without any sporting ability. I've never stepped foot inside a third world refugee camp or done anything particularly noble. And here I am, criticising the cream of humanity. But I think this is such an important issue, and the evidence of the brain drain when it comes to Rhodes Scholars is so stark that I'm willing to look like a complete bitch in order to make the point. Okay, first of all, let's look at where Rhodes Scholars come from, and then I'll look at where they're going to. The selected Rhodes Selectors I've spoken to have agreed that there is evidence that that more and more high-achieving high school students are being funneled into courses like law. And you can see this when you look at the high percentage of Rhodes Scholars who now come from legal backgrounds. So here are the statistics. If you look at New South Wales, in the first 58 years of the Rhodes program, only two of the Rhodes recipients were lawyers. Even by the end of the 1980s, so sort of the whole sweep of the 20th century, only another five law students have received the award, including some of the notable examples, Geoffrey Robertson and Tony Abbott and Malcolm Turnbull. So overall, if you look at the stats up until 1990, fewer than one in 10 Rhodes Scholars in New South Wales had studied law or came from a legal background. Since 1990, half the Rhodes Scholars in New South Wales are lawyers. Half. That's massive when you consider that we could be giving this award to scientists or engineers or historians and a million other different professions. That level of concentration, I think, is quite startling. But what about the question of where Rhodes Scholars go to? What about the Rhodes Scholars who do defy the pressure to study law, the ones who follow their passions, whether it's science, arts or engineering? Well, this is where the story gets even more depressing, because the answer is, more often than not, that these Rhodes Scholars end up as management consultants, or bankers, actually. In fact, I noticed from someone's Facebook update that someone I know recently, that a Rhodes Scholar, she's just gone to Deutsche Bank, which is another example. But
It's just Freehills calling, anyway.
It's fine. Don't worry, Gary, it's all been legal.
It's the litigation department. It's just all
right. So what was I talking about? Rhodes Scholars, management consulting. I think the way to think of management consulting firms is they're like the driftnet fishermen of the intellectual seas. Just as the wide and deep nets used by driftnet fishermen catch sharks, squid, marlin and bottlenose dolphins, the driftnet of management consulting catches future physicists, lawyers, engineers, paleontologists, entrepreneurs, urologists and doctors. Even the high-achieving students who defy the pressure to study law and choose engineering, physics, history, theology or economics can be trapped by the net of management consulting before they graduate. And I just want to give you three examples of some truly amazing people who have, Rhodes Scholars who have been lured into management consulting. And again, I just want to make it clear that I'm sure these people are much better human beings than me, so I do feel like a bitch naming them, but I think we need to make this point. Okay, she represented Australia in swimming. She wrote her geography honours thesis on refugee repatriation and undertook work experience with the United Nations High Commission for Refugees in Timbuktu. She later worked for the United Nations on a program to raise awareness about refugees in schools. She studied at Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar before being recruited by the Boston Consulting Group in Sydney as a management consultant. She graduated with a degree in mining engineering from the University of New South Wales in 1992, just fantastic. I mean, there's not that many women in an area like mining engineering. That's a real achievement. I'm not surprised she was given a Rhodes Scholarship. But after studying in Oxford, she returned to Australia in 1999 to work for McKinsey Consultants in industries ranging from consumer goods, manufacturing, to insurance and telecommunications, as well as mining. And then finally, the third example, who studied theology at Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar. In the 5 years after graduation, he taught ethics and theology, was ordained as a Uniting Church minister, worked as a university college chaplain, and held a fellowship in the Uniting Church's Theological Hall. He also wrote a book on Christian ethics entitled Christian Moral Realism. He then became a management consultant at McKinsey. So there are some really solid examples, and there are many, many more. I could go on through dozens and dozens of examples of these amazing people who end up in management consulting. In fact, the nexus between Rhodes Scholars and McKinsey is so strong that there has long been a rumour that McKinsey is the second biggest employer of Rhodes Scholars, particularly American ones, after the US State Department. Now, I contacted McKinsey about this, because I wanted to check. And they said, oh, yeah, we used to use that in our recruitment literature, but we don't use it anymore. And then they got frightened and then denied they had ever heard that statistic or had anything to do with it. So you can make up your own mind about which answer was correct, the first one or the second one. But this isn't just a problem for Australia or for America. It's a problem, this brain drain is happening all around the world with Rhodes Scholars. It's almost like just as Cecil Rhodes mined diamonds in Africa and sent the profits back to the heart of the empire, management consulting firms are mining brains from around the world and exporting the riches to the heart of the new empire, companies headquartered in New York and Boston. And for the record, if you think, well, why should we care if the selectors are happy, the people who choose the Rhodes Scholarship are happy for management consultants to be getting this award, well, what's the problem? But the thing is, they're not happy. I spoke to some of the selectors, and one in particular who said, I asked, so do people say in their interviews that they want to be management consultants or bankers? Do they talk about this openly? He said no. Not once in his 9 years as a selector has a single person said they plan to become a banker or a consultant. So something fun's going on. Brain drain, just to show that I'm not just making it up. I want to show how it's being recognised by people in positions of power gradually, and how the concentration of all this talent in a small number of corporate professions, so just to recap again, management consulting, corporate law and investment banking, it has a real effect in depleting other fields. In April this year, Mervyn King, who's the Governor of the Bank of England, complained to a British Parliamentary Committee about the excessive pay offered by London banks, which lures so many graduates away from other jobs. He said, I do think it is rather unattractive that so many young people, when contemplating careers, look at the compensation packages available in the city and think that these dominate almost any other type of career. And he said, it's not a very attractive situation that such a high proportion of our talented young people naturally look to the city and think it's the only place to work in. It shouldn't be. It should be one of the places, but not the only one. I think this is an important point, because the point is not that corporate jobs are evil. Like, I'm not saying, oh my God, people should totally quit their office jobs and become fire twirlers or whatever. That's not what it's about. It's about a disproportionate number of people going into a small number of professions. If the smartest grads were all being sucked into hairdressing or marketing or construction, we should be equally concerned. A couple of other examples of people recognising this brain drain are Jim Franklin, a lecturer at New South Uni in mathematics. He was talking about how in recent years, they're losing a lot of mathematicians to banking, including 4 recent PhD graduates to Macquarie Bank. And there's a serious problem with mathematics in Australia. There was a study by the Australian Academy of Science looking at how the number of mathematics teachers, both at high school and university level, is starting to become a massive problem for the economy, basically, because there's all kinds of things like engineering or a million other professions where it's really important to have good mathematics teaching to become properly qualified, but no one wants to do it because you get paid overall and it's much more lucrative to work for Macquarie Bank. So I think this is slowly being realised that this is a real problem. So what can be done about it? What are the solutions? I have a few small suggestions for what could be done to start to combat this conveyor belt of high-achieving students being sucked into a small number of prestigious courses and then into a small number of professions. I think, first of all, we need to reconsider the university admission system. At the moment, students are reduced to a single mark in the final year of high school to determine which course they can study at university. This encourages the idea that degrees can be hierarchically ranked according to the cut-off mark. It also puts pressure on ambitious high school students when they're choosing their subjects in year 10, 11 or 12 to choose safe subjects, which will not put their final mark in jeopardy. It teaches young people to choose marks over knowledge, benchmarking over happiness, safety over risk. More universities should consider offering medicine and law as postgraduate degrees, I think, so that the brightest students are not channeled into vocational paths when they're still teenagers. And this is starting to happen. Melbourne University has the Melbourne model. They're changing the way they do things so that first-year students are encouraged to do generalist, your classic degrees like arts or science, and then only later, as postgraduates, can they move on to law. Fortunately, there's a bit of a catch to their system, which is that you have to pay up front for that law degree when you do it at a postgraduate level, and I don't think that's ideal. But it is a start, this idea of encouraging people to keep their options open when they're 18. I think, second of all, another small thing that might help is for scholarships to be better targeted. It seems to me that there's little point in handing out free money to successful students from affluent backgrounds so that they can get better marks, which they can then use to secure a job at a top firm. This practice is a disgrace and a lost opportunity. Not to mention an unfair subsidy for firms like McKinsey. It's a subsidy for their training programs, basically. The Rhodes Scholarship selectors do the work of choosing the best and the brightest and then paying for those best and the brightest to be properly educated. And then they just pick them off. We're subsidising their training programs. Thirdly, I think student debt should be structured to encourage more altruistic choices. We're really lucky in Australia with the HECS system that you only pay back your student debt gradually depending on how much you earn, and that's a great system. But I think there should be more concessions for graduates who do move into fields like health and science. Fourthly, I think universities should be more circumspect about handing over their facilities and their eyeballs, the eyeballs of students, to public relations campaigns by big firms. Lecture theatres and assembly halls are turned over to big firms to script their wares without a balancing message about the other things you can do in life or some of the downsides of choosing these professions. And one example I think I always find amusing is that Sydney Uni has an alternative careers fair. It sounds like it would be like a really broad and exciting thing. It's got some of the people that have stalls at that alternative careers fair are the tax office and the federal police. So that's how narrow life can become as a law student. That suddenly seems like a, well, alternative thing to do. As well as providing a less thoroughly lubricated entry into big firms, I think more could be done to provide a more lubricated exit. It's common for professionals who have worked and studied overseas to feel the only way they can return home to Australia is by taking a job in a big firm, as governments don't properly recognise experience obtained overseas. There are particular issues as well in the field of education, with highly qualified graduates who may have honours degrees or even doctorates in literature or science, not being able to teach in public high schools because they don't have specific education qualification. So I was very excited to see, you may have seen in the newspaper today that Julia Gillard is actually considering introducing it. Which I think is a great idea, because I know a bunch of people who have been trying to escape law to go into teaching, but they've all gone into private schools because they're the only schools that have the flexibility and are willing to recognise the qualifications of people who don't necessarily have a qualification in education. But finally, I'd like to say that I reckon that in terms of solving this problem, the responsibility for the problem must lie with the disillusioned recruits themselves. After all, the overachievers we're talking about are hardly the most vulnerable group in society. They're young, but they're also intelligent and extremely well educated. This demographic includes some of the most fortunate people living at one of the most fortunate times in history. And the message I've been giving to people since I've come kind of in the last few weeks seem to have become this kind of poor man's Oprah for a few people coming up to me going, what should I do? How do I escape? I think that if you have the intelligence and the tenacity to get a job in one of those big firms, you also have within you the intelligence and the tenacity to get out and succeed elsewhere. You really do, and you probably will even earn a good income elsewhere. You shouldn't be afraid. And if they're still worried and they think, well, what am I going to do though? What will my parents think if I do this? Then I would say to them that the Pinstripe Prison would make a wonderfully passive-aggressive Christmas present for your parents.
Thanks. I'm glad we had this here. This has been uploaded on our pod, so I should start with a disclaimer. Some of my best friends work in the corporate world. Unfortunately, most of them couldn't be here tonight because, having spent the last two nights sleeping in the office, they had to head down to the union club for a shower. But otherwise, Lisa Pryor's book, The Pinstripe Prison, Janet Grundy's got copies. It's $32.99, but you can get it for the special price of $33 because you're all here because you're worth so much money. Okay, so now we come to questions and discussion. Can I start off? I just wonder if you haven't pinched something from the Prime Minister's address to the Sydney Institute dinner when you say at page 237, how to fly the ideological flag of convenience, having left university and gone to into work in corporate Australia. What you say at uni, smash the state. What you say at work, I think we have really moved beyond simplistic ideas of left-wing and right-wing. That's what Mr Rudd said at our annual dinner. So tell us about the move from university to the corporate world as depicted in the Pinstripe Prison.
Yeah, well, Jared and I were talking about this upstairs just earlier. But I think one of the core problems and the reasons for this whole phenomenon of people being also right on at uni and then managing to sell out when they get into the corporate world is that, again, I'm going to sound like a poor man's Oprah, but it's about this people not really having a sense of themselves. And they develop all these amazing educational qualifications and acquire all these accolades, but they don't actually know what they believe in. And I think that and it seems like as well, there's a big thing. It was like Rufus Black as well, who's a fantastic person. He, one of the Rhodes Scholars who went into management consulting, he also talked about at uni about how it was all about developing a third way and how, you know, we shouldn't be worrying about left and right anymore. Seems to be a bit of a theme.
Okay, so down there, yeah.
Oh, okay. Thank you for that. I was just wondering, the time when the Rhodes Scholars changed from being Harveyan lawyers to general law lawyers coincided, if I'm not mistaken, roughly with the period when it changed from being all men to women who were permitted to obtain Rhodes scholarships. That's a slightly disconcerting correlation. I was wondering if you've got any comments on that. But even more seriously, I wonder whether or not there's an ever so slight element of the, dare I say, cultural cringe about this concept of Rhodes Scholars being the crank of a crank. Maybe it's not until we have Wentworth Scholars and people coming to Australia and sufficient money in our tertiary system to reverse it, that we'll get round is that if we look beyond the Rhodes Scholar, say Fulbright Scholar Park has developed the same thing, that the old Rhodes Scholars were there, this is my fourth century.
Yeah, I think that... I hope that it's just a coincidence that the increase in the number of female Rhodes Scholars has coincided with the increase in the number of lawyers getting the award. And from what I can remember from what I've seen, I think it is actually a fair mix. There's plenty of guys who are doing law who are getting Rhodes Scholarships. So I don't think that's the only problem. But I don't think that when you're talking about the issue of the road sort of being the be-all and the end-all of this ultimate accolade, I think that is an issue that I wonder whether it's almost like a self-selecting process. The kind of people who fight really hard to get a road scholarship are the kind of people who do really value those like brands, basically, those kind of outward and obvious signs of success, because there is a lot of kudos that's associated with that award. It's not just about getting...
Question here in the beginning. Mine's very easy. Did you apply for Rhodes, and if you did, did you get one?
No, I didn't. I've never applied for a Rhodes Scholarship. I haven't... you have to do an honours degree to apply, and I had no interest in doing honours. And I'm absolutely appalling at sport, and I don't think my marks would be good enough either. So that maybe itself, right?
So you're still supposed to be good at sport for Rhodes, are you?
Yeah, although apparently debating counts as a sport.
And chess, presumably, as well.
Oh, of course. Yeah, that's, at least that's sort of vaguely possible.
Yeah. Is it? Did you ask any of the corporations you spoke to, the management consultants and law firms and so on, the level of political involvement and outside activity that they found acceptable, or whether or not, you know, some of these people would love to get along to the Sydney Institute more often, but, you know, were being pressured or frowned on? Or,
well, I think...
Well, not the Sydney Institute.
You would think that it might be a mark against your name, say, to write down on your CV that you were a member of the Socialist Alliance or something like that. But it actually isn't. Firms seem to love recruits who have all kinds of interest in these outside interests and are kind of idealistic. It's almost a point of pride, I think, for partners of law firms to think, wow, we're working in the kind of profession which is so exciting that even socialists and circus performers and conceptual artists and whatever want to be a part of what we do. And I went to a Malison's lunchtime lecture, actually, which was designed to recruit people from Sydney Law School to go to Malison's. And the partner proudly talked about one of their recruits who had done an honours thesis in autoerotic asphyxiation. Seriously. As proof of what an amazing group of people when he talked
about. The tip is, if you get an interview, you learn this at the Sydney Institute, if you get an interview, take along a copy of the Green Left Weekly is the way to go.
Notwithstanding your wonderful examples, And some of them seem to prove the best advisors don't go into these law firms, like, for example, the last one you just quoted. But have you looked beyond Australia, first question? Secondly, is this really to do with 100 years of change in the structures of society? I mean, 100 years ago, if you were a working class kid and you wanted to get on in the world, you went into school teaching because you actually got educated at college and you might even finish your HSC. That's 100 years ago. And then everything's changed in the sense that law firms, when I was at university, was, you know, not even a couple of partners, and, you know, they were a bit like suburban law firms are now. And then somewhere along in the 80s, they all became ginormous structures and bureaucracies. At the same time as our public service wound back. So, in a sense, if you're best and brightest, and you're not coming from people who are going to give you a walk into Millionaire's Row, and you're trying to make the best of your education, which societies like Australia and America, where people in Britain want to do, you have to go into these kind of structures to use your brains to the best of ability to make, you know, the most of your chances in career. So to what extent is it a structural thing, not just choice?
I would agree. I think it is a structural thing. And I think it's an extremely sad thing that the way we talk about a career in education now, for example, is how people might have once talked about joining the priesthood. It's not seen as an ambitious thing to do. It's not seen as a path towards anything. It's seen as an amazing charitable choice you're making because you don't care about ambition and you don't care about money. And it shouldn't be like that. It shouldn't have to be such a distinction.
If I could start with the proposition, I suppose no one would disagree with, that the world needs law firms. Having worked in one myself for 4 or 5 years, I agree with a lot of what you write in that book. And probably the one question for me is, what should firms do differently? Because my experience working in firms, which include the ones you name specifically in that book, is that they are... It is engaging work and it is quite rewarding and you get the privileges which you mentioned. And it is hard work and it gets you down at times, but you know that going in. And so I guess I wonder what would you expect a law firm experience to be different to how it is now?
So the question is for that, in fact, what would you expect the law firm experience to be other than what Lisa portrayed it tonight? Yeah.
Well, I don't want law firms to treat their staff better. I don't... seriously, because I think often this problem of, like, particularly depression amongst lawyers is talked of in terms of what could law firms do slightly better to make people happier in their jobs. Whereas I think the problem is bigger than that. The problem is that there's people in law firms who should never be there in the first place, who aren't interested in that type of work and who could be doing something they really love elsewhere. So I think... like little concessions in terms of treating people slightly better and giving them a flexi day once a month is just going to keep them like frogs cooking in that pot until they boil. I don't think the solution is about making people slightly happier in law firms necessarily. That's my answer.
So the question down the back can come up here.
I sort of grew up in the US system where we went to undergrad, which was a lot of education and the kind of thing you're doing in Melbourne system. And then what happens then is the brightest are picked up again by the consulting firm that I work. Not in line that I'm right, but just that I picked up by the consulting firm. But then in the US there's this other problem of the competition of the consulting firms and the law firms is something like Google and other high-tech and other sort of techy firms. Is it perhaps the fact that in Australia there aren't as many of those alternatives, and should there not be a policy push instead of changing the supply side to the demand side and fostering the types of companies that could compete with the consulting firms, etc.?
I would agree with that. As I mentioned, I think particularly people who have studied overseas have real trouble returning to Australia and finding the kind of high-powered jobs that they're capable of other than in big firms, and that is a real shame. And I think it's also something that the clients of management consulting firms should take into account, that consultants are being paid millions of dollars to tell entrepreneurs and businesses how to run their business, and yet they're full of people who are the opposite of entrepreneurial. They're risk-averse. They're avoiding the... They don't have the qualities that you need for business of getting out there and taking a risk, and that's a real problem. And I think it would be great if there were more people, more entrepreneurial companies for high achievers to get involved in. Except the problem is it's almost the mindset of high achievers, because so many people are waiting to be lured and seduced and told they're wonderful and recruited by a company, and the only companies that are going to do that are the ones like the consulting firms and everything. If you are interested in being proactive in business, you actually have to go out and make the opportunities yourself, and no one is better placed to do that than extremely educated high achievers.
Could I ask this gentleman?
No. We don't ask the audience. We ask the speaker.
Yeah.
Start a bad precedent. Everyone starts asking everyone else.
I was wondering, Lisa, the gentleman who spoke before, he said that he had worked for one of your firms, the firms you were referring to for a few years, and does not work for them now. I was interested to hear what he does.
He left Clayton Utes 2 years ago, and he's now working as a vet.
Philip Street runs outside there, you can ask him. And we don't want to start a bad precedent. Yes.
I'm an ex-lawyer and I work for one of the investment banks that you mentioned. I've had an interesting experience in the last couple of weeks where I've been helping my cousin, who's doing law, to apply for jobs for next year. And even I was blown away by the fact that she got acceptances from two firms. And one of them sent her the job pack in a leather folder to then take to work with her when she went to work for that firm. The other sent her an iPod.
Huh?
I mean, I was blown away, and I actually think that there is some blame that should be attached to those firms for putting sort of that cast over the job offers that they're making and sort of creating this atmosphere for the graduates.
Yeah. Wondering where you were when I was writing this book. That's a great
idea. The suggestion is that some firms should be condemned for being nice to your cousin, I think. You gave her an iPod and something else.
A leather bag,
yeah. Okay.
Yeah, that is amazing. That's a great anecdote. And as I was just saying, it's a shame that I didn't know about you when I was writing the book, so I would love to have included that anecdote. It's great. And I agree that I think firms do have to take some blame for being so manipulative of people who are actually so young and naive. Because even like something like a free iPod doesn't seem like much when you're 30, but when you're 21 and you're struggling to pay your rent and you're living on baked beans or only having the occasional Thai takeaway, it feels like a big deal. That is a pretty exciting world that you've been introduced, where people just give you free stuff.
Seductive.
Very seductive. Very seductive. Mm. And but I think the real problem is that it wouldn't be such a problem if there was someone else in the another argument being put to someone like your cousin, saying, well, actually, here are the downsides of what you're thinking of doing. At the moment, there isn't. Like, even universities allow, just open up their assembly halls and their lecture halls to big firms, allowing them to give away free stuff and tell lies with no alternative message.
They should have fine print on the employee contract.
Well, I don't know. I mean, they're not telling lies. I mean, you don't know what has to go there.
Yeah, well, certainly none of the people who are sponsoring the Sydney Institute are telling lies. Yeah. It's the other one. But it's true. It's not lies, is it? It's just building your
lead. I would have loved an iPod. I mean, I once applied for a job at a legal firm. I still haven't replied. 40 years ago. Every day I go down the post and I still haven't replied. I never tried again, so I left law. Now, there's a question here, yeah. I would have loved an iPod, yes. Sorry, leave it a copy of the Green Left Weekly.
This is more a comment than a question. And my name's Byron Cross. I'm a partner at Crawls Chambers Westgarth, which happens to be...
We've got a little bell.
was my former employer, and yeah. I must say, it doesn't get any... I didn't make any harsh mentions of them. It's my favourite law firm that I work for.
I mean, I'm not here to give an apologetic to partners of law firms, but I would say, just to pick up the point about telling lies at fairs, I'm part of the summer clerk recruitment program. There hasn't ever been a summer clerk I haven't said, look, this is a really hard job. If you want to do this job, sometimes it's very demanding. The hours can be very long. But, you know, it is also a very satisfying job. I enjoy the company of lawyers. I like the debate that we have in the office about things that aren't legal, and I like the fact that lawyers do tend to have interests outside of law. It makes them more interesting for me in the office.
It's a fair point to make. Some people, like, there are lawyers who genuinely love their jobs. They find it incredibly satisfying. And one of the the upsides of so many people being trapped in corporate law is there's a lot of really interesting people to hang around with in those firms, even if they might be happier somewhere else.
Right. Oh, well, we've got to be quick. So right down the back, yeah, and then over here. Yeah, okay, down the back somewhere. Just go for it. Yeah, right. Yeah, there you go.
Right, I'm just wondering whether you think when you have graduates in the university studying more in their undergraduate subjects for kind of upwards of 5 years, whether there's any benefit in then going to law firms or consulting firms or banks before going into public policy or into government, because I've definitely considered going directly into policy, and I think you should be glad that I didn't, because I have no idea about business or the corporate world, so just interested in your thoughts on whether there's a benefit in doing a couple of years before going into government.
Yeah, I think there definitely is, as long as you keep your eye and your focus on what you eventually want to achieve. In fact, the best thing about a few years in a big firm is that it's almost like a finishing school for business. You do learn how to behave in meetings and what to wear, and all those skills are actually can be incredibly useful down the track. But I'd say that the only reason to go to a big firm for a couple of years is for the training. It's certainly not worth it for the money. Because the money actually in the first couple of years, particularly in law, is not actually that much higher than it is for a teacher in the first couple of years of teaching. So by all means, go for the training, but just make sure you leave when you say you're leaving.
Someone else down the back there over here, yep, yep.
Yeah, I'm quite slightly related. I was in corporate law both in New York and Sydney, and I got out twice in Vegas. I'm writing now, but one of the things we talk about a lot in the phrase we get in New York is the golden handcuffs. You know, talking about there are people who genuinely enjoy being lawyers, and there's plenty of people who really hate what they like and they hate it, but don't leave. And I know you talked a bit about this, but the phrase, the golden handcuffs, is that people start living at the means of their salary, they do start making this money, they get a mortgage, and they can't find work that interests them outside the law that pays them the same money, so they feel trapped. It's psychological, obviously, but it involves the whole change of life to what they're used to living. I got out because I lived below my means for 2 years to save money. And the other factor is that, you know, time. You're so busy that I think people don't even have the time to take stock, to think about what they would do,
sure,
let alone to actually do the kind of things, going out there, talking to people that you need to in order to secure, you know, to change careers completely.
No, I think that's a really fair point. It's like if you're working so hard that you don't even have time to do your laundry or see your mum, you don't have enough time to retrain in a new profession in your spare hours. But what you say about mortgages as well is really true. That's the thing that kept being repeated by people I talked to who had escaped was, don't get the big mortgage. Because once you get the big mortgage that you can only service on your corporate salary, you're kind of trapped. But one thing I would say, though, is I think I feel sorry particularly for American lawyers because of the way the massive amount that you pay for university education in America and the fact that you really need to be working full-time to have health insurance so you won't end up bankrupt if you break a leg. They don't have as many options about taking a lower salary or escaping. But we actually, in Australia, we do have those choices. We should actually be taking advantage of them. So it is a much easier thing to take a risk when you don't have a massive student debt and you don't have to worry about health insurance.
So we go here and then we go to court, yeah.
Lisa, you'd probably know from attending the admission ceremony of lawyers that the judge that presides often implores the newly admitted lawyers to think of law as something far more than just the business where you're in it to make money. You know, the noble ideals of justice always needing to be watched and whatever. I mean, does your book go into that much in terms of the high levels of depression that we keep on reading about as being so prevalent in the legal profession and why it is that, is it that people who are in law are battling with the idea of justice versus the reality that they're in a business just like everyone else in the economy is in?
I think that's definitely a factor, that it is depressing for someone who has done law because they genuinely believe in justice to find out it's got nothing at all to do with justice. It's extremely depressing. And obviously it's something that senior people in law are really concerned about. There's been a number of judges who have talked about this problem. And again, I think one of the problems is that the solution that's presented to the problem of depressed lawyers is how can you make life slightly better for them as lawyers? And that's totally a great thing to do, but it still ignores the central fact that a lot of people are working as lawyers simply because they got really great marks in year 12 with humanities subjects, and that's not actually why people should be doing law.
The final question, Paul Monet.
I just had my question stolen. I'm one of three investment bankers on the board of the Sydney Institute. and I made a special note of this morning that I got up to make sure I wore a pinstripe suit. But I noticed Vera did too. but I was going to say that, I was going to say facetiously, therefore, does that change your view of the Sydney Institute? But I'll try and make it a more serious observation.
I think it's a great reflection of the Sydney Institute, but they let me speak here, despite
of this,
you know,
I think
it's good.
At least I'm not a lawyer, anyway. So. I'm an investment banker.
Yeah, I must say, bankers are much happier than lawyers, from my experience of doing the research.
Well, I was going to make, you're being my question on the depression was they're going to be exactly that, because I can appreciate that in any profession, a lot of people go in young and find it's not what they want and get downhearted by it. But there are, on the same side, there are tens of thousands of people in the business who are there who really enjoy it.
That's definitely
true.
And I'm
probably the oldest investment banker you know around town.
Just for those down the back, Paul Manan was saying there are a lot of people in the business who really enjoy it. He's saying he's probably the oldest business around investment banker around town. He's still in the business and enjoying himself. So that's basically the question. Yeah.
Yeah, bankers in particular seem to be much happier than lawyers. And my belief is that it's because corporate lawyers are doing a deal with the devil and not really getting that much money for it. And bankers know what they're in there for. They know they're in there to make money. They're in there to be hard-ass and do great deals and be rewarded for it. And it's much more straightforward, and I think a lot more bankers are happy because of that. And management consultants also are happier than lawyers, but that's because management consulting is almost like a cult situation where people are, they may not be earning as much as bankers, but they're totally convinced that like they're creating cultural change and not just downsizing making people lose their jobs. So I take your point as well that, in fact, one of the awkward things about writing this book for me has been that some of my closest friends are people who are investment bankers and corporate lawyers and management consultants, and they love their job, but they've been very understanding.
I was very depressed over the weekend because I read your book and I figured out that I'd worked at Goldman Sachs. I was an investment banker. Everything was sort of getting I'm a bit worried what Gerald was going to say about our next board meeting.
I had lunch with a very good friend of mine on last Monday who had read the book, and she's a lawyer in a big firm, and she was quite relieved that she didn't feel terrible when she finished reading the book. And the reason why she actually thinks that it's because she did actually consider all these things as she went along. She really did think about whether it was really what she wanted to do and really evaluated that and concluded that, yes, it was the right thing for her to do. So I think as long as you're asking the right questions as you go along, well, that's all fine. Although I've got another friend who read it and decided that she had to quit corporate law and become a management consultant because they got shot at Switzerland for training.
Thank you,
Susan.
Well, that's the end of the formal proceedings. We're going to put on a special function tomorrow night for lawyers, we'll do a counselling session. if they're any still around tomorrow. But look, for tonight, we're all about debate and discussion here. We've had a controversial, or now what's now called a robust speech, followed by a very lively discussion period. It's been a great night. A good speech would be good when it's on our pod. There are copies of Lisa's book here tonight, and I'm sure she'd be happy to sign it for the extra cent involved. Take you up to $33. So for tonight, Lisa, well done. No doubt you'll be writing more, and we'll have you back sometime in the future.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.